these new clients came along. She has never actually met any of them. That's not how this new deal seems to work. It's been explained to her 100 times, but Felicity is still used to the old ways, the personal touch. If a client is in panto, say, Felicity is there on the first night, front and centre, flowers delivered to the dressing room. If a client is opening a local leisure centre, Felicity is there, local press in tow. Felicity's clients don't work all that much, and so, when they do, the least she can do is to support them. They used to work a lot. Sue Chambers would do bits of TV. Alan Baxter did the breakfast show on Chiltern FM. Malcolm Carnegie would do after-dinner speaking at rugby clubs. But not so much these days. Sue's hip means she can't travel. Alan had got in trouble for a post about Adolf Hitler on Facebook, and Malcolm Carnegie died at a service station. She still has the odd local radio DJ, as well as Miriam, who had been a regular on Bergerac for 2 series, and a disgraced ventriloquist. But, in all honesty, Felicity had been on the verge of admitting defeat until the woman in the trouser suit had rung her buzzer. 40 years in the business. Not bad. Never been rich, but never gone hungry. A couple of young clients who moved agencies when they made it big. No hard feelings, these things happen. A couple of youngsters who could have gone all the way, but didn't. The usual. But she was older now. She came into work because the alternative was to stay at home. And she preferred the phone not ringing in the office to the phone not ringing at home. Preferred having no work to having no family. So the woman who had visited, green trouser suit from Whistles, in Felicity's estimation, had caught her on a very good day. While they were having a nice cup of tea, Felicity had had to nip out to buy some milk, the woman had explained to Felicity about the world of influencers and brand management. Felicity had nodded politely and pretended to understand, and tried to drop a few names of people she had known at the BBC. Telling a story about once having nearly represented Angela Rippon, at which the woman nodded just as politely. It had seemed that the conversation was heading nowhere, until the woman offered her all that money. And before you knew it, Felicity Wollaston Associates had become Vivid Viral Media Agency. Bills and invoices with lots of different company names started to arrive, and Felicity bundled them up every Friday and took them to the post office to forward on. One of her favourite tasks of the week, because the post office is next to a nice coffee shop. Felicity wasn't ever quite sure of her role in the whole business, but she was assured that her name and reputation still meant a great deal in the industry, and the partnership had really begun to flourish. Every month, Felicity would find a sum of money in her bank account that was most agreeable. Enough for everything she needed, and she didn't seem to have to do very much to earn it. She opens an email from a Bonnie Gregor, apparently a home inspiration influencer. Usually she just forwards the emails on to a contact address, but sometimes she reads them. Bonnie is 25, has 2 kids, Maxie and Mimi, lovely names, and 14,000 followers on Instagram. She seems very nice. Spelling leaves a little to be desired, but Felicity is flexible enough to know that doesn't really matter these days. Maybe her new bosses will like Bonnie. So few emails are actually sent to her that at least she can be helpful by forwarding this one. She wishes, she supposes, that she had someone to talk to about all this. But her accountant died 10 years ago, her husband 5 years ago, and most of her contemporaries are out of the business now. She tried to read up on influencers. You must always do your due diligence. But it seemed a different world from the one she had understood. She even Googled Vivid Viral Media Agency, her own new company, and nothing seemed to come up except for her own postal and email addresses. Which was a funny way of doing business. But times change, don't they? So she potters along. She has just booked Sue Chambers to do a talking head on a clip show called Britain's Favourite Biscuits, which Sue could record on Zoom at home. Felicity will be by her side to ensure the technology works. She has also just booked Alan Baxter for a slot on something called GB News, and they were happy to send a car, although Felicity had been unable to argue them up from a Prius. Alan won't love that, but a car is a car. So, outwardly, things haven't changed. It's just the money, the odd bit of post, and the free gifts being sent to the office. Even now, she sees, stacked along the far wall of her office, crates and crates of X-Plump Collagen Lip Gel, Bomb Squad Protein Balls, and, making the entire wall glow an unearthly purple colour, a new delivery this week from a company called Crusher Energy Drink. What names these products have. What a business she now finds herself in. Felicity wonders, briefly, if she should be asking a few more questions about it all, before turning her mind instead to which Boots meal deal she is going to have for her lunch. Chapter 7. Steve Wheeler still reads about murder. Of course he does. Just as a retired centre forward still looks at the football scores on a Saturday afternoon. Takes a professional interest with his feet up. Likes to imagine he could still do the job if called upon, but is glad no one is ever going to call on him. He doesn't watch a lot of the true crime programmes because he knows the pain and sadness of murder, and also he can always work out who did it in the first episode. But sure, the odd thing catches his eye now and again. He's not made of stone. This one, Andrew Fairbanks is the name of the guy, jumped out at him from Friday's paper because he was killed in South Carolina. And that's where Amy is. That and the fact that the guy was shot, drowned, and attacked by sharks. Steve knows from experience that the box on the death certificate won't be big enough to fit all that in. But Andrew Fairbanks is someone else's business, and right now, Steve has his own business to attend to. It was indeed the daughter who had been stealing from the shop, as Steve knew from the moment he took the job. Molly Bright is her name. And her eyes are currently filling with tears. "I would never, never steal from my mum," says Molly. "Never."
"And yet here you are, on camera, stealing from your mum," says Steve, showing the girl the footage from his hidden camera.
The girl watches the footage and tries to think of a way around it.
"I was borrowing it."
"That's fair," says Steve. "When are you planning to give it back?"
"Soon," says the girl.
Steve nods.
£300, give or take, over the last month.
"Oh no,"
says the girl. He might ask Amy about the murder when they next chat. He can't just talk about new postmen, can he? Rosie D'Antonio sounds like a nice, easy job. Amy deserves one. He knows Amy can handle herself. He once saw her knock out an MMA fighter with a single punch at a Christmas party. But he also knows the things that can go wrong. Steve worries that Amy will be killed. Amy worries that Steve doesn't eat properly. Steve worries that Amy and Adam don't see enough of each other. Amy worries that Steve is lonely. There is a healthy equivalence of concern, and also, they make each other laugh. He looks at Molly, tears in the corners of her eyes.
"Saving up for something?" he asks her.
Molly shakes her head.
"Bought something?"
Steve asks. The girl shakes her head again. "Given it to someone?" The girl does not answer, but this time does not shake her head. There we go.
"A boy?" asks Steve. "Or girl?"
Molly looks away, thinking. She looks back at Steve, then she motions to the floor.
"Is that your dog?"
Steve looks at the dog. He'd half forgotten he was there.
"No, some campers lost him. I have to give him back.
You want to stroke him?
He seems friendly."
Molly starts to stroke the dog. The dog rolls over on his back.
"How did you find him?"
"You know the horses at the back of the Matchwood campsite?"
Molly nods.
"I figured he probably followed them all along the fence, you know, dogs and horses, and walked too far to find his way back. I took the jacket of one of his owners and placed it on the ground near the stables. When I went back this morning, the dog was sitting on it."
Shouldn't you have taken him straight back?
Steve shrugs. The owners have gone to the Bewley Motor Museum. Asked if I'd hold on to him for the day. This makes Molly look at Steve quizzically. Steve shrugs. They're from London. They're used to being pampered.
Would you call him?
Lucrative. Molly nods and turns her attention back to the dog. After some silent cooing and stroking, she says,
A girl at school told me I had to get her the money. She knows I work here in the holidays.
Steve nods. Threatened to beat you up?
Something like that, says Molly. Worse.
Internet bullying? Steve asks. He's read about it. Molly nods. Well, this won't stand. Does she have a name? This girl? Molly shakes her head. Should be easy to find then, says Steve. A girl at your school with no name. That'll stick out.
Lauren Gough, says Molly. But don't speak to her. She'd kill me.
I won't speak to her, says Steve.
Promise?
No, says Steve. He bets that Lauren Gough is Gary Gough's daughter, and every copper in Hampshire knows where Gary Gough lives. Steve likes fitting things together, just as a hobby now, you understand. He had pootled about online this morning, reading about Andrew Fairbanks for an hour or so, trouble dozing on his lap. Fairbanks was a fitness guru on Instagram, though Steve noted that he had only 18,000 followers, which seemed a little low for an influencer. Even the Steam Museum in Lyndhurst has 8,000 followers, and you're not likely to see Ernie Dubbs, life president of the museum, with his shirt off on a yacht anytime soon. Fairbanks had been in South Carolina to film a short ad for a new energy drink. Again, with 18,000 followers. Steve looked up the name of the company behind the ad. Why not? Something to talk to Amy about. Vivid Viral Media Agency. Offices in Letchworth Garden City. Are there really viral video agencies in places like Letchworth Garden City? Seems odd to Steve. Gets his detective senses tingling, but, you know, someone else's problem. Someone else's murder. The door to the office opens and Molly's mother, Jenny Bright, walks in. Any luck? You could say that, says Steve. Is that your dog? Asks Jenny. About time you got a dog, Steve. I don't like to see a man living with a cat. It's off. No, says Steve. Long story. But here's the news. There's nothing on the video. He sees Molly's quick glance. So, it's no one on your staff. I was 5 minutes away from sacking Mrs. Thompson, says Jenny. So I suppose that's good news? Where's the money, though? Quite the mystery, this one, says Steve. Someone slipped this through my letterbox this morning. Steve takes out the envelope of cash the Londoners gave him to find their dog. It has, To Steve Investigates, written on it. He pulls out £300 and hands it over. They'd paid him way too much to find the dog, so it would be nice to do something useful with it. Steve sees Molly avert her eyes from the dog for a moment.
The money? Asks Jenny. All of it?
£300, says Steve. No, nothing. Whoever stole it must have felt guilty, or was only borrowing it. I choose to think it was someone terrified of my investigative skills. Thank you, Steve, says Jenny. That's a weight off. What do I owe you? On the house, says Steve. I didn't have to do anything, just bent down and picked up an envelope.
Can I give you a scented candle at least?
Don't believe in them, I'm afraid, says Steve.
I'll have one of those notebooks with a New Forest pony on the cover, though, if you've got one going.
Coming right up, says Jenny, and heads back out into the shop.
Molly waits until her mother is out of earshot. Thank you, you're kind.
Steve stands. I choose to be kind sometimes. I'm not always. I just can't stand a bully.
I'm sorry, says Molly. Do you have any daughters?
Yeah, says Steve. Well, no, a daughter-in-law. I don't suppose that's the same thing, is it? It feels like the same thing. Anyway, if anyone threatened her, I'd kill them. Which isn't kind.
There was no mention in anything Steve read of who was sailing with Fairbanks, or who might have shot him, or where that killer might have disappeared to.
The police, quite rightly, keeping that kind of thing to themselves for now. The public always wanted to know everything straight away these days. There was a short clip on Sky News of the sheriff, a man named Justin Scroggy, avoiding the questions of the assembled media in a very professional manner.
"We will not rest until the killer of Mr. Fairbanks is found," he said.
You really only say that when you know you're not going to catch the killer. If you know you're going to solve it, you just keep quiet, or you look straight into the camera and say, "We are actively pursuing a lead." Scroggy didn't seem right to Steve either. Hair and uniform too neat to be a cop. Perhaps Steve's being too judgmental. But being judgmental is a good thing, if you're right.
"I'll pay you back," says Molly. "It might be a while, though. I'll get 40 quid a week."
"Listen," says Steve. "Why don't you take this dog for a walk so I can go to the pub? Then we'll call it quits."
"Deal," says Molly. "You won't kill Lauren Goff, will you?"
"Ah," says Steve. "We'll see." The tiniest, tiniest part of Steve is envious of Justin Scroggy and the case he has in front of him. But a pint and a pub lunch will fix all that. Chapter 8. From the desk of François Loubet, ChatGPT, rewrite in the style of a friendly English gentleman, please. I do like to write things down from time to time. It's pure vanity. But everyone wants to be understood, don't they? For reasons of privacy and security, and to avoid serious prison time, I have never received credit for my many, many crimes, and it would be nice to receive a bit of credit when I'm gone. For the people who love me to truly understand the scale of my achievements. Though I promise not to be gone any time soon. To wit, a jolly interesting email has arrived. What do you make of this, I wonder? "Monsieur Loubet, please, 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 Andrew Fairbanks has to be the last death. No more killing. This is not what I asked for. You can have all the money back if you make this stop. Joe Blow." Goodness gracious me. First, I should introduce Joe Blow, my partner in crime. Could be a woman, could be a man. Perhaps Joe is using ChatGPT just like me. "ChatGPT, make me sound like a whiny troublemaker." I shouldn't mock. This business frightens some people. But my point is that Joe Blow could be a 60-year-old lorry driver from Inverness, for all I know. That's the joy of ChatGPT. Marvellous invention for the writer and the criminal alike. Whoever Joe Blow is, they work for Maximum Impact Solutions, I know that. And whoever they might eventually turn out to be, I have been paying them for some time to provide me with couriers to help with my business interests. And now it seems that my partner in crime is getting cold feet. Sometimes they do. It's a blasted nuisance. Perhaps Joe Blow needs a lesson in manners. Shall we? "Oh, I quite agree, Joe. I quite agree. No more killing. Though I note that there have only been 3 deaths. And in the grand scheme of things, I would argue that does not constitute an awful lot. Let us not dwell on semantics, though. We are friends. And this latest one, Mr. Fairbanks, might finally do the trick and frighten Jeff Nolan away, shouldn't you think? No more blasted trouble from him after this one, is what I surmise. Believe me when I say I understand the ambit of your queasiness. But you cannot take my money and not expect a little blood on your hands. That would be, with respect, naive. You must keep the money I have paid you. You have earned it with all the information you have sent me. However, we had a deal. I can suggest investments, if that would be at all useful. One mustn't urinate a windfall against a wall, must one? You will be glad to hear that our arrangement is now over, unless Mr. Jeff Nolan continues to contact me, in which case our connection will resume. Gosh, Mr. Jeff Nolan is a man who does not seem to take a bally hint. You do have to accept we have acted as a team, though, Joe, and that these deaths are as much your responsibility as they are mine. Where there is money, people die. You wanted my money, and thus you find yourself here. Amy Wheeler will be the last one, I promise. Does she need to die? To be discussed. But I do believe that her death will tie up any loose ends. I trust I have your cooperation in this matter.
Although perhaps we should dispose of Jeff Nolan, too. Would that be overkill? Please forgive my pun, Joe.
With warmest regards,
François Loubet.
There. I think I have made myself plain to our friend Joe Blow. The problem is, people are very happy to make a few pounds sterling off me, but they can get very squeamish when the bullets start flying and the sharks come out to play. There are many, many layers between me and these murders, but it always pays to be cautious. That's the lesson I hope I am teaching you here, in this silly voice I am growing to love. I'm not worried about Amy Wheeler, please don't think that, but I admit that I shall sleep a little easier when she is dead. Must get on to that. I shall talk to my man soonest. Tally-ho!
Chapter 9.
Eaten by a shark, says Rosie D'Antonio, throwing a towel over her shoulder and heading for the sauna.
Probably already dead, though. So that would have taken the edge off.
Yes, agrees Amy, and watches her client go. While Rosie has been reading out the news report, Amy had kept a straight face, not a flicker of emotion. But from the moment Rosie mentioned the name Andrew Fairbanks and said he was an influencer, Amy knew she was in trouble. She opens her laptop and heads straight for the same report. There he is, Andrew Fairbanks, smiling his final smile. He must have died 50 miles or so from where she's sitting right now. A painless death if the bullet had killed him, a horrible one if it hadn't. She checks one final detail online. As she suspected, Andrew Fairbanks had been a client of Maximum Impact Solutions. Something was most definitely up, and Amy was at the heart of it. She messages Jeff Nolan immediately. Andrew Fairbanks, am nearby, advise. Jeff recruited her personally 10 years ago now. She was the receptionist at a gym in the city. Concierge, they called her, but Amy didn't think concierges spent as much time as she did unblocking toilets. It's where she had met Adam. She caught him trying to steal one of the towels, and soon they were in love. A fight had broken out one day in the gym. Two steroid-crazed bankers, huge men both, started hammering each other with free weights. Amy had run into the gym, disarmed one of the men and tackled him to the ground, while a series of young men in singlets pretended they had been about to rush forward to help her. Meanwhile, another older, utterly harmless-looking gym member had somehow got the other monster in a chokehold. She knew the older man as Jeff, as he was always forgetting his locker key. When the police arrived to take the two meatheads into custody, good luck, officers, she had asked Jeff if he was okay and whether he might like a complimentary glass of elderflower tonic. Jeff had replied that he was quite all right, thank you, all in a day's work, and wondered if Amy might like a job. There is a message on her phone. Jeff, we need to talk. You're telling me, thinks Amy. The day after the fight at the gym, she'd had an interview in a suite on the 80th floor of a nearby iconic office building, which she has since learnt never to mention for reasons of security. After she passed through a series of electronic doors, there stood Jeff Nolan, looking very different in a suit. Jeff proceeded to test her computer skills and then asked her to punch him as hard as she could. Amy had always been strong and fast, always known where her body was and what it could do if she asked it. She could lift, she could hit, she could pivot, she could glide. Her computer skills were very poor, but Jeff, getting up from the floor after she had hit him, told her they could soon teach her those, and offered her a job on the spot. Self-protection had been a lifelong necessity for Amy, so the idea of protecting others seemed a natural fit. Jeff then made her do a psychopath test of his own devising, and was delighted to see she scored 80 out of 100. 75 was the cut-off point for Jeff. Anything under that, and you could be certain a new recruit would be too emotional. Jeff himself had scored 96, a number matched only by one other person, whose identity remained a secret, but who was widely supposed to be Henk. And now Jeff Nolan, a man provably lacking in gentle emotional intelligence, needs to talk.
Any time an ex-boyfriend had needed to talk, Amy had gone for a long run, deleted his contacts from her phone and moved on. Lots of people need to talk, but Amy is not one of them. And neither is Jeff Nolan. Jeff must know what Amy knows. They haven't spoken about Bella Sanchez or Mark Gooch. The coincidence. But now they will surely have to. Andrew Fairbanks too. It's too much. What will Jeff do? Will he give her some benefit of the doubt? Let her plead her case? She messages Jeff again. I know what you're thinking. You have to trust me. Amy looks out across the ocean to the mainland, the beautiful South Carolina shoreline framed with oaks and cypresses, huge magnolia trees covered in moss, greens and whites and blues. Amy needs to talk through everything that has happened with someone, to spell out the facts of the last few months. Would anyone understand? Who can Amy trust right now, thousands of miles from home? She hears Rosie approach, flip-flops slapping on the stone.
Are we allowed to ask someone to come out to fix the sauna?
I don't ask for much in this world, but 2 days without a sauna and I'll kill you and I'll kill Kevin and then I'll swim to the mainland.
I'll do it myself, says Amy. I'll watch a YouTube video.
May I ask you about something?
You can ask me anything, says Rosie. Ex-husband's rehab, Burt Reynolds.
I'm an open book.
I might be in trouble, says Amy. And I don't know if there's a way through it.
There's always a way through trouble, says Rosie.
Often into more trouble, but at least it's different trouble. You fix my sauna, and I'll fix your problem.
Rosie pulls up a sun lounger and, as a mark of respect, sits on it rather than lying down. She pours herself a large gin and tonic.
May I have one too? Amy asks. Do you mind?
Finally, says Rosie, unscrewing the cap once again. I thought you never drank when you were on duty.
They don't test us for alcohol, only drugs, says Amy. And I suspect I may no longer be on duty.
Oh, says Rosie.
Oh, says Amy.
Let me tell you a story.
Chapter 10. It's the same crowd in the Brass Monkey most lunchtimes, and this Friday is no different. The widowers, the divorcees, and the lushes. Each has their own area of expertise. Steve himself, widower, is asked all the legal stuff. John Todd, lush, who used to work on the Southampton Mercury, gets asked the show business gossip. The mechanic Tony Taylor, long-term divorcee, long-term lush, takes care of all the car problems, occasionally branching out into microwave and coffee machine repairs. And Dr. Jyoti Das, widow, alcohol tolerance building steadily, fields all and any medical questions, despite the fact she's a doctor of medieval history. In the pub across the road, the Flagon, a similar, but by all accounts inferior, grouping can be found. Steve is very much the star man in the Brass Monkey, and occasionally there are entreaties from the Flagon as to whether he might be tempted across the street at some point. But Steve is loyal. Steve is steadfast, and currently, Steve is having trouble with the clutch on his Vauxhall Corsa, something that Tony Taylor might be able to fix. So he is a Brass Monkey man through and through.
That's what killed him?
The shark? Asked Tony.
Probably the bullet, says Steve. The shark was attracted by the blood.
You wouldn't want to be eaten by a shark, says John. I was stung by a jellyfish once in Portugal and it hurt like hell.
You pee on it, don't you, Jyoti? Asked Tony.
A jellyfish sting.
Dr. Jyoti Das, doctor of medieval history, nods.
Neutralizes the toxins.
Who shot him? Asked John.
Steve shrugs.
I'll ask Amy about it, she'll know.
Amy will chat very happily about the killing. Too happily for Steve. Amy never talks about her childhood, but he picks up snatches here and there. It is clear that violence has been ever-present in her life. She takes it in her stride in a way that makes Steve sad.
How does Amy like Rosie D'Antonio? John asks.
Seems happy, says Steve, glad to think of something more positive.
Good fun, apparently.
I'll bet, says Tony. I'd love a crack at her, given half the chance.
I'll mention it to Amy, says Steve. See if Rose is in the market for a mechanic with kidney stones.
Did you ever interview her, John?
Asks Jyoti.
Rosie D'Antonio?
No, says John.
There was a bloke in Andover who wrote a book about horses once. I interviewed him, the author's life and whatnot. They kept me away from interviews, by and large.
And this Andrew Fairbanks, says Jyoti, our shark friend. He was famous too. Have I got that right, Steve?
I'd never heard of him, says Steve, but I've never heard of anyone these days. Steve thinks about those 18,000 followers again. Something doesn't sit right. Not his business, but he couldn't help that little old alarm going off in his head. And Letchworth Garden City, come on now. If murder was still his business, that's where he'd start looking. But it's not, so he won't.
Instagram, says Tony, and they all nod.
Their food is brought out and placed in front of them. Two shepherd's pies, a beer-battered fish and chips, and a lamb shank. Same as always. Tony collects the cutlery and napkins from the tin at the end of the bar and passes them round.
Blue car in the car park last night, Steve,
says John, tucking his napkin into his shirt like a cravat.
Appeared from nowhere.
I'm across it, says Steve, starting to make inroads into the shepherd's pie.
Greg's packet in the footwell too, says Tony.
Must have come from somewhere.
Have I told you about my recycling bins?
No, says Steve, and signals for another pint.
Someone's putting stuff in them, says Tony. Like, I'll leave my glass bin out, and I'll wake up in the morning, and there's pizza boxes, all sorts in there. Anything you can do?
Steve gives it some consideration.
Why don't I bring my Corsa around to yours this afternoon? The clutch is sticking? We can have a chat about the bins while you take a look.
Thanks, Steve, says Tony. You're a mate.
You can catch people on your doorbell these days, can't you?
Could we try that?
That'd be perfect, says Steve. I can take a look through the footage for you.
What footage? Asks Tony.
The footage from your doorbell, says Steve.
From the camera?
You can download it.
There's a camera on my doorbell.
What sort of doorbell do you have, Tony?
I don't know, says Tony. I've had the same one since 1985. It came with the house.
Okay, says Steve.
How did you think people were catching criminals with their doorbell?
Just out of interest.
Fingerprints? Says Tony.
Steve nods. Of the four of them, Tony is the one not on the quiz team.
What was he doing there anyway? Says John.
Who?
Asks Steve. Sometimes this little lunchtime gang can lose focus.
Fella on the boat, says John. Shark boy.
Advert, says Steve. Flew over there to film something. Crusher energy drink.
You'd solve it soon enough, says Jyoti.
Not anymore, says Steve. I don't solve murders.
Crusher energy drink, though. That's another lead, surely.
How did they get involved?
Why did they choose Andrew Fairbanks for this particular campaign?
They get back to their food.
No doorbells on a boat either, says Tony.
Wise words, Tony, says Steve. You wouldn't get this sort of quality at the Flagon.
Chapter 11. The first one was a woman called Bella Sanchez, says Amy, sipping a gin and tonic through an elaborate straw and shielding her eyes from the blazing South Carolina sun. A client of Maximum Impact. I'd seen her on Real Housewives of Cheshire, then on Cheshire Divorce Lawyers, then on Celebrities Go Dating, and then back on Real Housewives of Cheshire.
That's quite the arc, says Rosie.
I like the sound of her.
She got called to a job in St. Lucia, an advert or something. You know, just a social media post. They get paid a fortune for this stuff.
Did she have millions of followers? Asks Rosie.
Someone at my publisher's does my Instagram for me. Probably for the best. I'd be cancelled by lunchtime.
No idea, says Amy. Enough to do an ad, clearly.
Good name for a book.
Cancelled by lunchtime, says Rosie.
An assassin who works only in the morning?
Something in that. In the '80s, I advertised Dubonnet. Do they still make Dubonnet?
I don't know, I'm afraid, says Amy.
Do you want me to get to the murder or not? Rosie gestures to Amy that she has the floor.
Just adding some colour, darling.
She goes to a hotel in St. Lucia, says Amy. She has a meeting with someone.
With whom?
Couldn't tell you. Not my job to look into it, says Amy. Penthouse suite. There's a final photo of her, lip-plumping gel held up to the light. That's what she was promoting. Then she's shot in the head. One bullet.
Like Andrew Fairbanks, says Rosie.
Very like him, agrees Amy, especially as she is then hung upside down from the balcony, for the world to see the following morning.
Wow, says Rosie. Upside down, how dramatic.
And a client of Maximum Impact.
A platinum client, yes, says Amy.
Why aren't I platinum?
Asks Rosie. Platinum is the lowest, says Amy. It goes platinum, platinum plus, platinum XL, platinum gold, platinum diamond, and platinum platinum. You're amber, because someone actually wants to kill you.
What do you get for platinum?
Consultancy, advice, basic security checks as and when you might need them. But we wouldn't have been guarding her. Platinum clients don't get bodyguards.
Andrew Fairbanks was platinum too.
Amy nods.
And then a month after Bella Sanchez was killed, a man called Mark Gooch, a financial influencer, another platinum client of Maximum Impact, goes to Ireland.
Uh-oh, says Rosie.
He's there to do an advert for a brand called Punk Wine. He's at a vineyard somewhere in County Cork.
A vineyard in Ireland?
Climate change.
Takes a final photo?
Guesses Rosie.
Takes a final photo, confirms Amy.
Sitting on the bough of a tree, top off, drinking from a can of wine. And his body is found about an hour later.
Hanging from the tree?
Nailed to it, says Amy.
Bit of variety, says Rosie.
But I get it. Three deaths, all linked.
Nice start to a story. But where do you come in? Hero? Villain?
Andrew Fairbanks was killed, let's say, 50 miles from here, says Amy.
Or so, agrees Rosie. And?
When Bella Sanchez was murdered in St. Lucia, I was in St. Lucia.
Ah, says Rosie.
So perhaps you're not the hero.
I was maybe an hour away, says Amy. I thought at the time, well, that's weird, but nothing more than that.
What were you doing in St. Lucia?
Working with a musician and...
Which musician?
Asks Rosie.
It doesn't matter, says Amy.
But I... Come on, says Rosie. Just say.
I can't say. You know that, says Amy.
Huh, you want my help and yet here we are.
Okay, it was Elton John, says Amy. Now can we...
I've had some fun times with Elton, says Rosie. Some fun times.
He's calmed down a bit now, but haven't we all? Did you like him?
I did, says Amy.
Did you like him more than you like me?
At this exact moment, yes, says Amy.
Okay, says Rosie. On with your story. So far, you're on a killing spree.
When Mark Gooch is found, just guess where I am.
Nearby, says Rosie.
Nearby, says Amy.
With a hammer and some nails?
Asks Rosie.
In Dublin. With Bono?
No, with my husband. About an hour away by helicopter.
I have a helicopter, says Rosie.
I think I do.
Sure I bought one.
I've definitely got a plane.
So I was beginning to feel paranoid. Bella Sanchez, then Mark Gooch. Maybe just a coincidence, but it didn't feel right.
And then I read you the Andrew Fairbanks story.
Three murders, three clients, and I'm in the neighbourhood every time. Someone must be trying to connect me to these murders.
You know I have to ask if you killed them, says Rosie.
I'd get it. Capitalism isn't easy on any of us. You could just snap.
I didn't.
Or perhaps someone was paying you, Rosie suggests.
For insider information.
You didn't pull the trigger, but there's still blood on your hands. Good money?
What does your instinct tell you, Rosie?
Oh, I know you didn't do it, says Rosie.
Not with those crazy ears.
So, is someone trying to frame you for three murders?
Amy shakes her head. She doesn't know what's happening. Her phone pings. She looks at Rosie. It's Jeff.
The boss?
Amy nods and looks at the message.
Remember that job we did for François Loubet?
He is behind this, and we are both in trouble. I need you back in London. We can discuss everything. Stay safe.
François Loubet, the money smuggler.
They'd been protecting a woman who worked for him. Henk had been furious that they were working for such a notorious crook. That was the start of the end for him and Jeff, really.
What's he saying?
Amy is thinking. Fairbanks was found with a bag of money, that's for sure, but the others weren't. Another message comes through.
And do you know the name Joe Blow? Does that mean anything to you?
Joe Blow? Means nothing to Amy.
Nope, should it?
I mean, I'd be furious if I were him, says Rosie.
You just shot three people, hung two of them from ropes, and nailed the other one to a tree.
I'd certainly be calling HR.
He needs to talk to me, says Amy. I have to get back to London.
Rosie gives a dubious purse of the lips.
What? Amy asks.
Are you sure that's the best idea?
Rosie weighs up the question with her hands.
It's just that someone seems to be going to an awful lot of trouble to make it look like you killed three people. Someone who knows where you are at all times. And I'm guessing Jeff knows where you are at all times.
Jeff's on my side, says Amy, but someone is setting me up and I have zero idea of why.
Rosie shrugs.
I suppose the police, God bless them, didn't solve the other two murders? The lady and the man in the tree?
They didn't, says Amy.
Then perhaps you should find out who actually did kill these three people to rule yourself out. And as you said, we're only about 50 miles from where Andrew Fairbanks was murdered. I mean, goodness, it's a hop and a skip, isn't it? It's sort of our duty to go take a look.
Another message from Jeff.
And tell me if Henk tries to contact you. Do not trust him.
Jeff and Henk used to run Maximum Impact together. Henk had tried to poach her when he first left Maximum Impact Solutions, but Amy knocked him back, and she hasn't heard from him in months. Why would she hear from him now? And why shouldn't she trust him? There are more immediate considerations at this exact moment, however.
Rosie, says Amy, you are not leaving this island. Whatever is happening, there will be an explanation. I'll go back to London in the morning. Kevin will take care of you here, and it will be sorted out.
Unless someone is out to get you, says Rosie.
And then you'll probably end up dead or in prison.
Which I believe is very on-brand for Watford.
Rosie, no one is going to get me. We've got three dead clients already. If I take you over to the mainland, you'll be an open target for Vasily Karpin.
I'm not going to end up with four dead clients.
Four dead clients, says Rosie.
Another good name for a book.
Chapter 12.
From the desk of François Loubet. Chat GPT, rewrite in the style of a friendly English gentleman, please.
Mr. Kenner,
the time has come, old bean.
Everything is in place, I trust. Please advise when Amy Wheeler is dead.
Warmest regards, François Loubet.
Old bean. Sometimes chat GPT can be a bit much. Rob Kenner is my murder broker.
Very good. You'd like him.
I don't need him to tell me how Amy Wheeler is going to be killed. I simply trust that he is going to take care of it as a matter of urgency.
I almost feel sorry for her.
She didn't ask for any of this, did she? She's simply the wrong person, in the wrong place, at the wrong time. Just another layer of security for naughty François Loubet.
Chapter 13.
Gary Goff is nodding. Only it was a lot of money, says Steve. And the girl was terrified.
Not sure I'm getting you, says Gary Goff.
I just thought you might want to have a word with her, says Steve. Ask her to lay off.
Not really my business, says Gary.
Well, Lauren's your daughter, says Steve. That's sort of your business.
Kids,
says Gary. They've got lives of their own.
If she wants to make a bit of money on the side, fair play to her. You can't watch them 24 hours a day. I'd rather she was beating up her classmates than on a bloody phone all day.
Steve used to have to deal with the Gary Goffs of this world day in, day out. Look around the New Forest long enough and there are still a few of them about. The ones successful enough never to have been caught. Clever enough never to have been too flashy. Smart enough to have got out at the right time. With their high hedges and their ride-on mowers, going mad with money and gin. Gary will still have a trick or two up his sleeve, but Steve has no interest anymore. When you arrest a Gary Goff, another Gary Goff pops up in his place, then another, then another, then another. A sea of Gary Goffs, just waiting their turn. Sometimes one Gary Goff will shoot another Gary Goff, then a third Gary Goff will wreak revenge. It's so bloody tiring and so bloody boring. But Steve can't stand a bully, so he thought he should at least pay a visit. "How much?" says this particular Gary Goff. "How much what?" asks Steve. "How much for you to go away? How much did Lauren nick off the girl?" 300, says Steve. Gary laughs. "Christ, that's what you're here for, 300 quid. He opens his wallet and takes out a sheaf of 50s. Steve waves the money away. "I gave her the 300. She doesn't need your money."
"You gave her the 300?
"Someone from London overpaid me for finding a dog," says Steve. And Gary Goff nods in understanding. "I just thought you might have a word with Lauren. Ask her to leave this girl alone?
Pick on someone else?
Or maybe don't pick on anyone," says Steve. And Gary laughs again. "Law of the streets, old friend," he says. "Law of the streets." "You don't live on the streets anymore," says Steve, getting up to leave. "You live in a mansion in a village with a delicatessen and a gastropub. Your daughter has a horse. She's not some tough kid fighting her way out of poverty like you were. She's a rich bully. So remember what you thought of rich bullies when you were growing up." Steve takes his leave, walks around the side of Gary Goff's house, and gets into his Vauxhall Corsa. It is parked between a Range Rover and a Lexus. Steve had really been hoping to use Gary Goff's loo before he left, but he felt his parting shot was so good that he didn't want to draw focus from it. Had Gary Goff been listening? Maybe, maybe not, but Steve had tried. He'll drive back the long route. It's Italian night at the pub this evening. They do a bolognese, and a bloke from Havant sings opera. He'll go home, have some quality time with Trouble, maybe collect his dry cleaning, then a bit of TV, and he'll head to Tony's, then the pub, remembering, of course, that he needs to collect the dog from Molly Bright. Just 10 minutes with Gary Goff had reminded him how much he hated his old world. Give him dogs and shops and ponies on notebooks. He messages Amy. "When's good to chat?" There is a delay in her reply. "Might need an hour or so. You okay?" Another delay. Steve looks out of his window. The mighty forest growing about him, giving way to gorse-strewn heathland patrolled by armies of ponies. Finally, a reply. "All good here." Amy is normally a little more chatty than this. Perhaps she is busy. Though how busy can you be on a private island? Steve asks her the question he's been dying to ask. "Glad to hear it. I want to talk to you about a man called Andrew Fairbanks. Heard of him? The shark influencer man?" He knows she'll respond with a bit more enthusiasm to this one. He passes a beautiful whitewashed pub. A man, with his top off, sits with a pint while his dog nuzzles the nose of a curious pony. Amy seems to be composing a reply for quite some while, and when it arrives, it reads simply, "Yes." Less enthusiasm than he'd hoped for, but he's glad she's heard of the case. That'll be a fun chat. Steve had looked up Crusher energy drink online. There didn't seem to be any adverts for it. A rudimentary website where the buy now button didn't seem to work. And strangest of all, the registered head office was at the same address as Vivid Viral Media. Must be owned by the same people. Makes sense. But a bit of Steve is tempted to go up to Letchworth Garden City. He's not sure why. It just feels like there's a stone in his shoe. But not his
business.
When he gets home, he'll send Amy a heart emoji. Something in her tone has worried him. Probably nothing.
Chapter 14. Dubai, that gleaming temple of sunshine, money, and glorious possibility. Whether you're after a $200 steak or a rocket launcher, you will find it here, in a world of speed and heat and handshakes. Huge buildings reflect the sunlight, at once dazzling newcomers and hiding the insiders. The whole city is a giant turbine constantly eating and creating money. A merry-go-round that spins night and day. It has been the making of Rob Kenner. To the outside world, Rob Kenner is a DJ, travelling the world from glamorous party to glamorous party. It's a hell of a lifestyle. Just take a look at his Instagram if you have any doubts about that. Look at Rob's villa on the Dubai Palm. Look at his Ferrari, wrapped in metallic gold. Must be a lot of money in DJing. And there is a lot of money in it, that's for sure. Or there was, back in the day at least. But even then, there wasn't Ferrari money in it. So Rob has always had side hustles on the go. And Dubai welcomes side hustles. While DJing is not a bad business, murdering people for a living is a great business. Robust. Recession-proof. The world economy can tank. Fuel prices can rise, clubbers can stop listening to 90s trance music, and interest rates can go through the roof. But people will always want to murder other people. And Rob acts as the middleman. Tell him who you want killed and where, and he'll find someone for the job. No need to tell him why, any more than you'd need to tell a newsagent why you want to buy a newspaper. Rob only started a couple of years back. He was into all sorts of other bits and bobs beforehand, but he's got some very nice contracts now. It all began with François Loubet, really. Loubet heard about him, used him, then used him again. Word got out that Loubet trusted him, and then the business started pouring in. Minimum charge, $100,000, but that goes up steeply, depending on the job. And no shortage of clients. All Rob has to do is to pick up the phone to the right person, and it's done. And Rob Kenner always knows the right person to ring. And now a new job from Loubet. Amy Wee... Hmm? He says.
You're shot, dickhead, says Big Mickey Moody.
Miles away, says Rob. Dreamland. Mickey Moody, the big lunk, has never killed anyone. You can just tell. Some people don't have it in them. But that doesn't make them any less of a human being, does it? We're all built different. Big Mick hasn't killed anyone. Rob doesn't like sushi. Horses for courses. They both like golf and sunshine, though, and that's enough. Rob steps up to the tee and pulls out his driver. He looks down the fairway, picturing his shot. So François Loubet needs Amy Wheeler dead too. She's a professional, so it's not one for a gun-happy local cop. Fortunately, the perfect man for the job is already there and should be easily persuadable for the sort of money Rob can pay. Because Amy Wheeler is a pro, Rob's commission will be around $200,000. He'll offer the shooter $50,000. Easy money for them both. He'll make the call. Yep, he thinks. The Dubai sun dancing on his visor to the sound of birdsong and high-performance sports cars. It's not a bad old life, is it? Rob Kenner then hooks his tee shot into the bushes. In fury, he throws his driver over a ducking caddy and into the trees, while screaming an obscenity that frightens the birds.
Unlucky, Rob, says Mickey Moody with a sympathetic smile. Not always your day, is it?
Chapter 15.
Amy is outside, on Rosie's afternoon sun terrace. She hangs upside down from an exercise bar and stares at her phone. Steve wants to talk to her about Andrew Fairbanks. How can that be? Something very strange is going on, and Amy is at the heart of it. Perhaps Rosie is right. Perhaps she should be cautious.
Amy developed a keen sense of danger from a very young age, but she also developed a keen sense of who to trust. And she trusts Jeff. The supply boat will be here in an hour or so. Amy plans to hitch a ride and fly to London from Savannah later this afternoon. She starts doing crunches, the power of her muscles defying the power of gravity. Who is killing these influencers and why? If it's all tied to Francois Loubet, is it a money laundering scam? What if Bella Sanchez and Mark Gooch were carrying bags of cash too? How can she find out? She starts working her body harder, adding a twist to the crunch. Jeff will have answers, she's sure of that. She's sad to be leaving Rosie behind, but she will be in safe hands with Kevin. Amy just needs to get back to London. Then she can...
On the floor, hands on head. If you reach for your weapon, I will shoot.
Kevin. The man who had so recently brought her an oat bran porridge with chia seeds now has his gun pointing directly at her head, albeit upside down. Amy manoeuvres herself off the bar and gets onto her knees, her fingers laced behind her head. What's happening here? Where's Rosie? Amy asks.
I've told her to go to her panic room, says Kevin.
You think I'm dangerous? Amy asks. That's been your observation, has it, over the last few days?
Yep, says Kevin.
He's no fool. Amy is dangerous. Kevin circles behind her, gun still outstretched. Is she being abducted? By whom? Doesn't Kevin work for Jeff? Amy weighs up the odds. Kevin is around 6'2", must weigh upwards of 260 pounds. If she can unbalance him, it's an easy win for her. But Kevin is an ex-Navy SEAL, and Kevin knows that he is 6'2 and heavy. So Kevin also knows that if Amy can unbalance him, it's an easy win for her. Kevin is therefore keeping his distance and letting the gun do the work. Amy hears handcuffs. The second Kevin reaches for her wrists, he will be doomed. Once she overpowers him, she can worry about what to do next. But Kevin does not reach for her wrists. Instead, he throws the handcuffs down onto the floor next to her.
Put them on, he orders, and I'll need to hear a click.
There is usually a way out of any situation, that is, if you really assess every angle. Would a leg sweep reach its target? No, Kevin is standing out of range. Might these handcuffs themselves be a weapon? An improvised nunchuck. She weighs them in her hand, strong but light. No use. Negotiation, then. Did Jeff ask you to do this, Kevin? To take me in? Why the handcuffs?
Someone asked me, says Kevin. You don't need to know who. And they said she'll beat you in a fight. And if she can't beat you in a fight, she'll talk her way out of it instead. Handcuffs on now, or I fire.
You don't need to handcuff me, says Amy. I'm going back to London, I promise.
You're not going back to London, Amy, says Kevin. Sorry. I've been given a job to do and a lot of money to do it, so no fuss.
Who gave you the job? Amy asks. Where is Kevin going to take her? Was it Jeff?
Handcuffs on now, repeats Kevin.
You know that Jeff has...
If you say the word Jeff one more time, I'll shoot, says Kevin. That's a final warning. Now do me a big favor and click those handcuffs on.
Of course, sometimes the solution to a situation is that there is no solution. And in those instances, you sit tight, shut up, and make sure you find a way of stopping yourself getting killed. A very familiar feeling for her. Amy reluctantly accepts that this is where she stands right now. She brings her hands slowly from behind her head. Even slower, commands Kevin. She reaches down to her left to pick up the handcuffs.
Behind your back, says Kevin.
You think I can handcuff myself behind my back?
I do think that, yes, says Kevin. If you fumble, I'll shoot you.
It is a breeze to handcuff oneself behind one's own back. Annoyingly easy. Amy places both wrists through the bracelets. And click, says Kevin. He still has a dab of flour behind his ear from making Rosie her pancakes this morning. And click. That's it. Amy is handcuffed. She's on an island.
She has a highly trained ex-Navy SEAL pointing a gun at her, and soon she will be either dead or on a one-way plane ride to God knows where. She also has a client shut up in a panic room. The door opens.
"Well, I never," says Rosie D'Antonio, looking at the kneeling, handcuffed Amy. "I have to say, my money was on Amy overpowering you. You clever thing, Kevin. All this, and you can also knock up a decent souffle."
"I have to request that you return to the panic room, ma'am," says Kevin. He turns back to Amy. "Get on your feet."
"Yes, I decided I wouldn't go into the panic room until I knew Amy was okay," says Rosie. "You see the sort of person I am, Amy? Even after everything you've done?"
"I've done nothing," says Amy, getting up.
"I believed you at first," says Rosie.
"But no smoke without fire. You can take the girl out of Watford, but can you ever take Watford out of the girl?"
Kevin nods.
"I'm taking Amy into the panic room."
Kevin forces Amy forwards, his gun in the small of her back. Amy is struggling to come up with a plan. The door to the panic room is open. It is at least 10 inches thick and framed with a vacuum seal. He won't kill her, surely. Who on earth would want her dead? The room itself looks like a perfectly pleasant place to spend her next few hours. A big sofa, a TV, a drinks cabinet, another door leading to a bedroom. She'll be comfortable while she awaits her fate. Kevin forces her inside.
"At least tell me where you're taking me," says Amy.
"I'm not taking you anywhere, Amy," says Kevin. "I really am sorry, but it was a lot of money."
So this is it. In her line of work, she often thinks about where it's going to end. A military checkpoint in Syria, an opium den in San Salvador. That she made it through childhood was miracle enough, so she can't really complain. She thinks about Adam, and she thinks about Steve. Will they cry, she wonders. Kevin digs his gun deeper into Amy's back and forces her onto the floor. "Of course they'll cry, Amy. They love you. They love you. You found love against all the odds." The scene is playing out for Amy in the mirror above the bar. She looks so beaten, arms behind her back, big Navy SEAL with a gun directly behind her. Who is doing this? Who needs her dead? Why? And then, Amy can see a golden trophy held by a small hand come crashing down on Kevin's head. She spins as Kevin falls to the floor and kicks his gun across the panic room. Kevin is stunned but quickly back on his knees, scrambling towards the gun. Amy drags herself to her feet and runs out of the panic room, heading back into the house as Kevin aims and fires. She falls in a heap on the hallway carpet just as Kevin's first bullet thuds into the door of the panic room, which Rosie has swung shut.